show. Everyone's expecting. If you know them well, you know. Do as I say, not as I do. Welcome, friends, you know.
Hey, welcome everybody to Drunk Dudes in a Gun Room. Today we have got a great show. The show is brought to you by Operation Encore. They are a 501c nonprofit helping veterans do great things with music. Today we have got an amazing guest. We've got a book that we're going to talk about that he wrote. When I read this, what the book was about, man, I started rolling. So I can't wait to get into it. The gentleman's name is Dick Wybrow. Dick is a best-selling author of more than a dozen humorous supernatural thrillers, a former stand-up comedian, and a major market radio host. Dick has spent the majority of his life avoiding proper jobs. His latest novel, Kane, has been atop Amazon's bestseller list since its publication. Book 3 in the series is out December 29th. So let's bring on Dick. Hey, how's it going?
Good, man. And greetings from sunny Auckland, New Zealand. It's tomorrow where I am right now. I'm in the future. So nice to chat with you.
Is the temperature nice over there? Or?
Well, I mean, it's our version of nice. New Zealand has been going through the rainy season, which started, this is what, November? It started in January. Okay. And it has not stopped. It's not, they keep saying there's going to be a drought. I say bring it on because it's just not ending raining. But in between the raindrops, we get little flashes of sunlight. And today, at this moment, it looks like it's going to be sunny. I can't quite tell, but it's been nice. We're coming into our summer now. You know, normally, obviously this time of year, y'all are getting a bit cold. And I know what Missouri can be like in the cold because I spent some winters there for sure. But here we don't get that kind of cold. It's pretty moderate. And so there's like a range of about 15 degrees or so for the most part throughout the year, at least this part of New Zealand. And so, yeah, it's nice. It's nice today.
So we can get into that because I know you said that you done some radio hosting in Missouri. How did you go from talking Ozarks to New Zealand?
So I was actually doing stand up comedy for a couple of years. like you mentioned, it was this thing where me trying to avoid actually doing proper work, and so I did stand up comedy for a couple of years, and then there was. You know, it was so great in the beginning, right? I was doing it up in Minneapolis, and Minneapolis was an amazing comedy scene. That's where like Louis Anderson came out of and all these other big acts. And you'd go in to these stages and stand up, and it was just this amazing, beautiful wall of people around you. It was just, I mean, and you hit a joke right, and just this wave would wash over. It was amazing. But then suddenly, I think programmers in television started to say, well, let me see. So if we take a microphone and get a guy in a hockey jersey, put him in front of a brick wall, we can sell that programming. So you saw at that time, you saw comedy, stand-up comedy shows all over the place. So it was on USA and A&E, everybody. And that started to affect clubs. So fewer and fewer people were coming out to clubs. And so my thought was, how can I continue doing what I'm doing in some fashion and not actually, again, get a proper job. And so that became radio. So I ended up going from 45-minute workdays to 3-hour workdays. But still, it wasn't so bad. And so one of the first gigs I got, because I was just starting, I worked at a place called KESM in El Dorado Springs, Missouri. And it was such a small station. I had it when I got there in the morning. It was a converted farmhouse, had the antenna out behind the place. And I actually had to come in and turn the radio station on. That's how small the place was. Fire it up. And then I did mornings there from like 6 to 10. And I'd been a Midwest boy. And I remember there was this lovely woman came on by and she gave me, she bought me breakfast. I guess my first day was very sweet. And I didn't know, at that point, I didn't know the rules about radio is maybe don't take food from listeners, but I didn't know that at all. And so she brought me biscuits and gravy. And I, again, I'm Canadian originally, and I'd been around the United States quite a bit. But I took a look at it. It was, thank you very much. And I opened it up. It's like, it's bread and gravy. Where's the meat? It's just starch and starch. But there were bits of sausage. I don't know what kind of sausage it was. It could have been a pet that she didn't like very much. Not really sure. But it was the first time I ever had biscuits and gravy, and I was hooked, man. That was really good.
Yeah. So
that, and I bounced all over the United States. Eventually, same sort of thing with radio. Radio changed a bit, so I hopped into television. My day went from 3 or 4 hours to 8 hours, which that's no good at all. I was going the wrong way.
Yeah.
I did television and popped over to New Zealand here about 11 years ago with my wife. And I'm just wrapping up a show that I've been producing the last 7 years. Then from here on out, it's just straight into the writing.
Man, that is awesome. I wish I would have met you a long time ago because I needed your playbook.
Yeah, it was, you know, it's like anything, you know, you bust your hump as much as you can, right? You just, you always want to be working harder than the other person. Yep. And I always did. I always did a lot of research and I always worked as hard as I could to make sure that what I was doing was what people wanted to hear. Yep. But you also need luck. There's always elements of luck. You can argue you can make your luck by putting yourself out there, but you definitely have to accept the fact that there's something, be it a spiritual force or God or whatever it might be, that says like, all right, let's give this guy a break. and it kicks you up a notch. And I've been really, really lucky in that part.
And you say like you wasn't trying to get a proper job, but like you said, content is not easy. You know, I used to joke and say, you know, people that do content was like, you know, millennial panhandlers. But when I started doing it, I learned real quick, this is not easy. So,
yeah, it's not like a radio show, for example. You know, it sounds like the guy just cracked open the mic and started talking. He was done.
Yeah.
There's so much that goes behind that. If it's a music station, that little minute or 2 minute talk set that he's doing, or if you're doing a talk radio format like I've done, there's so much work that goes into that. Yep. And arguably, some people say it takes an hour of work to get really a minute or so to make that work right. But it's, you know, it's about presenting the stuff, understanding the audience, and also being able to present something in a way that has a bit of an arc that doesn't waver too much, that people can follow along with it and enjoy it.
Yeah, absolutely. And the planning and like you said, even the marketing and everything else, it's a long day. So, yep, my hat's off to you. Great. So the writing process, that now that you are writing, because you know, I did a little bit of, I wrote a book that I haven't decided that I'm going to publish. And it was more of a explanation to my kids about a dark spot that I went through coming back. So I kind of, now that they're older and college age, I wrote down everything that I went through while I was over there. And it was just an explanation of, as they were growing up, why I had changed and what had happened and everything else. And I felt I owed them that. But when I was writing that, I learned real quick, writing a book is not just easy. It's not, you just don't put some words on a paper. There's a long process to this. So how did you transition from audio stuff to writing?
So when it comes to stand-up and with radio and all of these things, that is all writing, right? So if I'm doing stand-up comedy and if I'm doing a bit, that would be something that, in fact, I got into stand-up comedy initially because I started doing writing. I was writing short stories and things. Okay. And it was really difficult, still is, really difficult to get published, you know, to get in magazines and that sort of thing, right? You've got to lift yourself up. And if you don't have a name, you're not getting anybody reading you. So I got into stand-up comedy because that was my cheat, because I could write something that afternoon, go up on stage, and I was published. You know, I was being presented to a crowd. Yep. And that morphed into the radio stuff and then even some of the television. But so it's always been writing along the way. But it is a much different process sitting down and writing 90,000 words of a book, as you mentioned, or 45,000, however it might be. You know, the main thing is just get the words down on a page. And we can talk a bit about some of those processes. But the main thing is just getting those words down on a page and also being sort of open to, you know, not, I always feel, not being too governed by your own insecurities or biases or whatever it might be. Just let the story sort of tell itself. Yeah. Empower the characters. And I know it sounds flaky. Trust me, the flake alert. Empower the characters to start speaking through you. And then you, in a lot of ways, become the first reader because the story's kind of being told to you from your subconscious. And it's fascinating. It's an enjoyable process. And then once you get all that down, then comes the revision. And that's where the real work is.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So what was the first book that you wrote?
The first book I wrote when I was 17, and it was terrible. It was awful. I was so bad. I've got a buddy of mine, a guy named Brad Meltzer, who writes thrillers, and he would joke. He said, my first three novels were published by Kinko's. And that was really how it goes. You know, for the most part, it just comes down to, you know, getting an idea about how structure comes together, about when to bring in dialogue, when to break up paragraphs. It does take, honestly, a couple hundred thousand words or so to really start getting that into your head about how to make that work. To where now, and I'll tell you what, just as you mentioned, the third book in the series comes out in late December. But even going to this book, I was still, when I started writing it, I still had all those same insecurities. I had all those same questions of like, I can't do this. I don't know how to write. It still, all these years later, still bubbles up every time. But you push through that and you deliver.
Yeah. Yeah. So do you put yourself on like a schedule or do you just let it flow? And when it's done, it's done.
I write best in the morning. And that's the thing for any writer, you sort of find what works for you. The main thing is for as much as you can, you can't really have a lot of interruption. Stephen King calls it, this is the closed door time. Meaning that you just got to be blocked off from the rest of the world because it's a very personal experience, a very solitary experience. So when I write in the morning from about 4 o'clock in the morning to about 7:30, mm-hmm. and then marketing stuff after that. But you just find the time that works right for you. But really an important part of it is you can't do it on the kitchen table with people wandering about. You might have that ability, but I find that I can't be distracted by the people coming into the room and moving things around. I need that very solitary experience because that helps turn you inward to where you can find the stories.
Yeah, I mean, especially with what you were just saying, that makes a lot of sense because if you're sitting there watching TV or even listening to the TV while you're writing, I mean, the sounds that you're hearing is still influencing you. And what you're hearing could be influencing that story as well. So,
you can ask various authors. Some of them will have certain music they listen to. Like when I'm writing a book, I listen to a soundtrack. I listen to the same soundtrack. I've listened to the same soundtrack probably thousands and thousands of times. And soundtracks are good because there a lot of times there's not words to it. Because if I hear words in music, then suddenly my head starts following those words, anticipating the next words that they're saying. And that would pull me off entirely. So I listen to soundtracks. And I listen to the Tron soundtrack, the one from just a few years ago, Tron Legacy. And I listen to that. And as I mentioned, that plays through my entire writing process. It's kind of like a bit of a drone in the background. And I think it might be sort of entertaining some part of my brain that might be trying to misbehave. It keeps me distracted enough so I can do the work I need to do.
Yeah. I mean, that makes sense. You know, so I've had a lot of artists on my show, musicians, and I've had a few authors. You are the first non-veteran author on my show. And, you know, I've asked them the same question, you know, as far as why did you start writing? And their question was always about wanting to document what happened, you know. But when I talk to the musicians, they all say the same thing. They say that they don't really care about, you know, the stadiums and the selling of tickets and that side of everything. For them, it's about wanting people to listen to their music because they like their music, not because they're a veteran, not because of anything about their stories, just about because they really like their. Is that kind of true in the writing world? Is that, you know, they want people to care more about the story in the book versus the the dollars and the fame of being a famous writer, or what would you say the general census is for authors?
Well, the advantage of being an author is no one knows what you look like. So you don't have to worry about things like fame. I mean, there's the outliers, like the Stephen Kings, like we mentioned a moment ago. But for the most part, it's a way that you can turn it into a career or a full-time job, but they still have that anonymity. Because a lot of, I would say most writers in some way are introverts, mm-hmm. Or people that are quite shy. And so writing is an opportunity for them to kind of hide behind characters and let part of their personality out. When I first started writing stories, I was a chubby Canadian who just moved down with his family from Canada down to New Jersey. And so picture that, you know, 9-year-old kid, kind of fat with a Canadian accent in a Jersey school. Yeah, whatever. Yeah. So man, I had a target on me, brother. I had a big old target. And so I was really shy. And so the writing gave me sort of an opportunity to be able to find a voice. And it took me a good long time to share it with people until, in some ways, and this was a pivotal moment for me, at that very same school, there used to be three kids that would come on by, a couple years older, and they'd come on by the lunch table where I sat by myself, sad. You know, I was a new kid in town. Yeah. And they'd come and they'd say, like, "What you got for lunch today?" And it was terrifying. These older kids coming in, and it felt like they're coming in attacking me. And then they would take my snack pack pudding, because that was back in the day, this was the greatest, right? It was a snack pack pudding, and then you'd pull that metal lid off, and then you'd bend the lid, and then you'd use that, and just tetanus all through your face. You got tetanus everywhere, but it didn't matter because you got chocolate pudding. Yep. And so these guys would come on by, and they would ask me what you got today, and then they'd take whatever they wanted. And one day I was like, I just sort of snapped as a little kid, because I was a chubby kid without any friends. And my only friend was that pudding. I had to go into pudding defense mode. And so when they go, like, "What you got today?" I was like, "Well, I've got a booger sandwich." And I just flipped. And they laughed their butts off at this. And then they didn't take my pudding because I made them laugh. And that was like, the power of that is like, if I can come up with stuff, if I can be interesting or entertaining, it's a power shift, right? When someone's laughing, honestly, you're in control, but you're no longer down here.
Yeah.
And so then, of course, then I stitched myself up, as the Kiwis say, because now I had to write material every day, come up with gross out jokes to make sure I kept my pudding. But that taught me a lot. It taught me a little bit about not a little bit about writing, but more than anything about the extreme power of good writing or writing and humor, which to this day, I'm still always amazed by.
Yeah. You know, I was kind of the same growing up. I was popular during football season. You know, the girls all wanted to date me during football season. And then as soon as football was over, I was back with the weirdos, I was really good at football. But I was not good with people. But I was good at telling jokes and telling stories and making people laugh. And I was good at fighting. So people usually left me alone. But I was not smart and teachers didn't like me. And so I did kind of create problems on that side of the house. And so I didn't really fit in. So school was not a great place for me either. Right. But yeah, I do understand, because, you know, that's how I kind of, when I got uncomfortable, I would start telling jokes. And, you know, when people would make fun of me, I was really good at coming up with things on the fly to make them feel more insecure than I was.
Right. And
sometimes that worked good. Sometimes I ended up getting punched or, you know, hit. It wasn't what I was expecting, but,
Well, and for me too, you know, I grew up with a Kiwi father, and New Zealand males aren't known for their being affectionate, especially the older crowd, right? It just was never a thing. And so the one of the things that I sort of gleaned affection from my father was by making him laugh, especially because I could see in his face that he didn't want to necessarily, but if I could make him break, that was the affection I needed.
Yeah.
You know? And so again, finding humor, just finding what a voodoo that is, humor, you know, and the magic of what it can do. And it's real amorphous too. Like even when you were, you know, doing jokes or doing cut downs to other people, I mean, there's sort of patterns and mechanisms and stuff, but you've got to come up with something that they didn't come up with, yep. You know? And that it gives you a modicum of control, or at least the illusion of control, which sometimes is all you need.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. So let's get into this book that I discovered. Cause it, like I said, it wasn't on your page. When I was going through, so for everybody that listens, if you go through Amazon and you type in Dick Wybrow, it's going to come up with like a million books because there's a bunch of them out there. But if you go through, you're going to find one called The Swordsman.
Right.
When I read this, I couldn't help but to laugh because I was that zombie. I mean, I pictured myself being that guy that was on the interstate just wanting to eat people for the way they drive. Right. So let's talk about this book. How did this book come about?
So this was 2012 and in the very early stages of self-publishing on Amazon. And at the time, 50 Shades of Grey had come out. And this woman who'd written it had done really well. And then she did stupid well, you know, it was like the most popular book on the planet. Mm-hmm. And no shade to her. I mean, if you can make it work, you can make it work. Great. But reading it, it was just awful. You know, you read some excerpts of it, it's just awful. And so I'd come home from work and I had said to my wife, I just, you know, complaining about it. And at the time there were a bunch of these sort of mashups between historical stories or like Pride and Prejudice and zombies and things like that. And so I said, I should do a zombie book that has some attachment to this. And I could call it 50 Shades of Grey Matter because they eat brains. Ah. And I gave her just a little bit of the concept behind it. She goes, you should write that. I said, no, that's stupid. She goes, no, you might as well write it because nothing else you write sells. I was like, okay, well, that's nice. So I did. I wrote it and I wrote it in 5 installments. And so five installments. So I put the first one out in August. And it was, you know, it was like whatever it was, 60 pages or something like that. And, you know, it got a wee bit of traction or something, but not much. I was like, oh, maybe I don't understand this publishing thing. Well, I've already written the second book in this or the second portion. And so I put the second one out. And then it started to kind of take off. By the time I put the third, there's 5 sort of mini books into one. It just makes one entire story. By the time I got to the third one, it was climbing up the charts. And I was sitting back going like, I don't entirely understand why this is happening. I mean, how are people even finding this? And then by December of that year, it became the number one comedy book on Amazon. And I was just blown away by that. And it was thrilling because it's kind of a significantly silly story. Yes. And I do break fourth wall and all those kind of things. But the long and short of it is basically there's the zombie bird flu that's going around. And it's not quite like apocalypse or post-apocalypse. It's sort of that fuzzy in-between stage where people are kind of still going to work. And as you mentioned, it's hard to get through traffic because zombies, they love to drive. Yep. And they're kind of clogging up traffic. So it's just the beginning stages where people are just starting to turn more and more. And so this guy comes home from his job and his lady decides, well, he thinks his lady's going to treat him when he gets home to something a little special. But when he's in the process, he gets bit. And so he's turning. Now he's been infected. He's going to turn. But he doesn't want to do this. He doesn't want to turn. He doesn't want to become one of these mindless zombies. He's been a mindless zombie doing his graphic design job his entire life. He's going to end it. So he breaks into a CVS. The place is shredded because the place has been attacked already by people looting and all that. And he goes in and he finds a bunch of pills that have kind of been like locked up. And so he's like, I'm going to take these pills. I'm going to end it all. And he's just sort of crying to himself, singing song lyrics as he's choking these down. But he hasn't found like Oxycontin. He hasn't found any sort of painkillers. What he's found instead was like Levitra and Viagra. And so it has the effects that you would think it has. And as I say in the story, it's that little bit of blood that was misdirected from what might go into the brain, ended up in another part of the body. And as long as he remains a swordsman, then the entire effects of the zombie virus does not hurt him. He has some of the ability, so some strength and this sort of thing. He doesn't need to sleep, but he doesn't go full zombie. FZ, he doesn't go full zombie as long as he keeps popping Viagra through the entire story.
I will definitely find this.
Yeah, and he meets another guy, and then they meet this old guy named Mr. Johnson who drives around in a rascal, and they're all popping ED pills the entire time to keep the zombie effects at bay as they try and defeat the zombie horde. So it's a completely goofy book, but it's a lot of fun.
It sounds like it. You know, I just picture when you're sitting there writing this, where it's coming from. You know, you have to be rolling as you're putting this on paper.
You know, and it's one of those things, like, I mean, as I just even described it to you, why would you even write that down? You know, it's so dumb. But as I'm writing it, I could start to really hear these characters speaking. And then there's actually an entire beginning part of one book where one of the other characters, because it's told in first person, the main character, Hal, is speaking. But like in the third or fourth book, Mr. Johnson takes over. And so breaking the fourth wall a bit. But that sort of felt right at the time, that he would kind of be arrogant enough and let me take over the narration. And then he gets punished for that. But yeah, it was putting it down on paper. It seemed really goofy, but it's something I guess I had to get out of my system. And the great thrill when people really enjoyed it, and I start seeing some reviews come in. You know, some people are going to hate it because people always do, but the people that liked it really loved it. And that was such an unusual feeling to write something sitting in your bedroom at 3 o'clock in the morning somewhere. And a few months later, somebody 2,000 miles away is reading it and laughing out loud. That's a trip. That is an amazing feeling to have that effect on somebody.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, I agree. And the fact that, look, at the end of the day, in today's world, if you can bring laughter to somebody, that right there is an amazing feat. You know, there's so much negativity in this world, and to get somebody just to have those few moments where they can forget about the problems and laugh is awesome. So,
and yeah. Joy begets joy, right? So for as much as they're enjoying it, I'm enjoying that they're enjoying it.
Yeah.
And so it's reflective. And so, yeah, I'd love to be able to do that for people.
Yep. I agree. And like I said, when I was just going through, you know, before the show, when I was doing the research, what we were going to talk about. And when I came across that, I said, oh yeah, we have to talk about this. And I decided I'm buying it. So, you know, you accomplished two things. You made me laugh and you made a sell. So
great.
Yeah,
I hope you enjoy it, man. That's pretty. Like I said, it's 11 years ago or so. There might be some sort of outdated themes, but you know, and the world's changed in ways not a lot of us like. So maybe it's just right.
Yeah. No, I agree. And I don't have a great memory anyway, so it'll probably work anyway. So
great.
So let's talk a little bit about publishing. Have you always been self-published or have you tried to go the other route too?
Yeah, I had. So when I was in, I did radio in Southern California and I had some experience with agents. I had a Hollywood agent. I actually had the agent that produced Breakfast at Tiffany's. And he had done Volunteers later on and some other stuff. So he was really plugged in, but he was also old. He was hella old by the time I got to him. And that was a strange experience because there were people that were interested in the book, but he didn't want to pursue it because he was trying to get some other deals sort of haphazardly. So the book got optioned. It's called Being Optioned. So you get 90 days. And basically that means another, like a film production company will come in even before the book's published. Mm-hmm. They'll say, well, we just want to reserve this. Here's a couple dollars. We're going to reserve this for 90 days. So don't sell the film rights or TV rights to anybody else. But we reserve the right to purchase these rights for this 90 days. And so I went to him and said, well, great. Now we can take this interest because once somebody says yes, even a tentative yes like that, that gets other people excited. And I said, well, let's go approach publishers and say, look, this other company who later on produced Walking Dead, by the way, this other company wants to make this into a movie or TV show. Why don't you get on this as a publisher for the book? And he just wouldn't do it. And it was like, so basically he was just sort of waiting for the other side. He was waiting for these television or film producers, TV, to create something. And then it'd be an easier sale for him. I think he just got lazy. And so that experience really soured me to the publishing world because like I mentioned Brad Meltzer earlier, that's how he got his deal. Mm-hmm. He couldn't get published. He got optioned. They took that tentative option and went to a publisher and they thought, well, we might as well publish it because if it turns into a film or a television show, well, then the book sales will go through the roof. And that's how he got into publishing. And that didn't quite happen for me. So I got real disenfranchised. And the moment that self-publishing on Amazon sort of raised its head, then I got into it that way. So I've always been self-published, arguably up until the last couple of weeks, because the audiobooks for the Kane series have been picked up by Podium Audio. And if you're an audiobook listener, you know Podium. And so that's huge. So that's arguably, that's the first real publishing contract I've ever had.
Okay.
And the first one comes out here for the first Kane book comes out on July 16th. So keep an eye out for that. But yeah, that's real exciting to kind of like push aside that traditional world to take it on my own. And the traditional world comes to me, says, hey, we want what you're doing. That's kind of a nice little turnaround.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, let's face it, you know, how many industries has Amazon really turned upside down? You know, yeah. I mean, they started with books and when they said, we're going to sell them online, people were like, whatever, you know, and now they have made Walmart and movies and everything else completely revamped their industries, you know,
and they make television shows now.
It's not to say just because you're self-publishing that you can't become great. It's just another option, you know.
No, and there's plenty of examples. That there's a guy named Hugh Howley, the guy that did Wool. He's one of the more famous sort of independent or self-published authors, and Wool blew up like crazy, and they just turned it into that TV show Silo recently. The folks who came on to me, Podium Audio, one of their first big purchases was Andy Weir. An author named Andy Weir wrote this book called The Martian. And it seemed to be going pretty well of selling. And they were like, well, we'd like to turn it into an audiobook. And they turned that into an audiobook. And once they turned it into an audiobook, it seems like folks in Hollywood went, because an audiobook is acting. It's not just somebody reading a story to you. They act it out, right? Yes. And so I think that the folks in Hollywood heard that. And they were like, you know what? We could see that up on the screen. And then it became The Martian film with Matt Damon. And so, yeah, there's opportunities there for sure. And, you know, like we said before, you need a little bit of luck along the way, but you kind of got to put yourself into that space for that luck to happen.
Yeah. So if somebody was just starting out and they decided to go that route, because I do know of a veteran that she self-published. And she's got three books that she has released. It's a series called, I want to say it's called Flight is what I think it's called, or Fight. One or two. What would you suggest? What is the best way for marketing for somebody like that?
I think when you're first starting out, you got to focus on the writing.
Okay.
And the hardest thing there is you want everything to happen next month or even next year. And it might happen next year, but the odds are really against it. It's very, very, very rare for a newbie coming out to write a book and it takes off.
Right.
So just understanding that this is who I am, this is what I'm doing, this is going to be a process, and it's going to take some time.
Yep.
You know, I got lucky a bit with The Swordsman when I wrote that because there wasn't a ton of other self-published authors in that arena at that time, that mine stood out because it was maybe a little bit funnier than other stuff people had seen. These days, there's thousands, tens of thousands of self-published authors out there. So I think one of the first things when you first started out, if you're looking for results, if you're looking to be a bestseller by next year, I think you just sort of, I'm not saying don't believe in that, but that's great. But don't make that be, if I'm not a bestseller, then I'm a failure.
Right.
And understand that you're going to learn as the process goes. Like when I take a look back to The Swordsman or even the first Hellink book, which I wrote in 2018, I compare that to how I've written Kane. And the new series is on another level compared to the stuff I've written before. And a lot of that came from writing that original Hellink series. And there's 8 of 9 books in that series. But we're going to do the last book next year. But just, I think it's getting to the mindset. A lot of it's about mindset because it's an extremely solitary experience.
Yeah.
A lot of people take a lot of heart from joining writers groups online, and there's plenty of places to do that. Just Google around and find writers groups. Some writers can be kind of a little bit negative, but there's groups on Reddit and things like that. Mm-hmm. But I think initially it's just writing something that you feel is in your nature. I wrote 2/3 of a trilogy that was kind of a bit of a spy thriller thing and that's the thing that I ended up getting optioned, by the way. But it never quite took off, and I never quite felt that was exactly me. And so you'll hear this on occasion from mentors especially that say, don't try and write to the market. For one, the market changes so fast. What's going to be popular in 2 years, who knows what's going to be big in a couple of years, right? Yeah. So don't say, oh, people really like these kind of books, let me write that. Write what's in your own heart and stay true to yourself, because readers will pick up on that.
Yeah.
You know, it's a one-on-one relationship with somebody. And it's a little bit like when you hang out with your best friend and you get to know them, you know when there's something off with them. And that's what I mean. Readers will pick up on the fact that you're not all in. They may not be able to pinpoint what it is.
Right.
And that's why sort of the stories that I write, even though I would not define myself as a huge fan of supernatural, I listen to or read science fiction books more than anything. I feel most comfortable in a fun thriller sort of zone that has a little bit of magic in it. Not literal magic, but like in this case, it's a werewolf or a wolf were, because he's a wolf who is bitten by a man that turns into a human. But so I like normality that has just a little bit of extra into it. Because I think in some way for myself that I kind of hope that that's what this world is around us. That everything seems normal. Everything seems exactly what we think it is. But there's just like 5% that we don't understand, that a little bit of magic in the background. And so I love that concept. And so that's the world that I live in. So the main thing, I think, when you first start writing out, just write. That's the most important thing. Just start writing and try and do it every day. I mean, if you can't write a full chapter in a day, because it's not easy, just write a page. If you can't write a page, just write a paragraph. If you can't write a paragraph, write a sentence.
Yeah.
Because that helps build up a bit of confidence in you, because every word you write is a step forward.
Yep.
Right. And so when you start to feel stagnant, like, oh, I can't do this, just write a sentence. Now that sentence, you're that much farther forward towards what you want. So just do that every day. And that helps build up a little bit of momentum in your head. And the next thing you might write a lot more.
You know, it sounds like to me a lot of the advice that you're giving people is the same thing that I tell young, you know, I say young, like I've been doing it forever. You know, I've only been podcasting for 3 years, but is people starting out with podcasting. You know, I tell people, you know, that analytic button, just forget that it's there.
Yeah.
You know, don't look at it. If you're talking about what you enjoy talking about and you enjoy what you're doing, don't worry about what Joe Rogan's doing.
Yeah.
Just do it and have fun with it. Where it goes, it goes.
And there is some parallel between like writing and radio, because that's why I loved radio so much back in those days, because radio was a one-on-one relationship with the listener, because most people hear the radio by themselves. And so it's just you and the listener, where television is an audience, films are an audience, that sort of thing. It's the same thing with books. And people don't sit in groups, you know, like sharing the book together. It's you and that one individual person. And so if you can connect to that person, if you can connect, and that comes from just you writing what you love and writing the stuff you're really into and not trying to manipulate it in some way to meet the expectations of somebody else. Write what you're into, write what you love, and let that flow out of you. And someone's going to connect with it. Somebody out there, and maybe a lot of somebodies, will connect with that.
I agree. You know, that is some of the best advice, you know, and I, like I said, it being authentic and being you is the best place to start. You know, and if you're happy and you're enjoying it, you know, where else can you do something that you enjoy doing? Because
that was the main driver for the you mentioned the Swordsman book. The Swordsman book. I had no illusions that people would read it. I just, if nothing else, I wrote out of spite because my wife dared me. You know, so it's always good. And so when people started commenting like on the Amazon page where I was publishing these, I was like, oh, wait a minute, there are people reading it? That's weird. Why are they doing that?
I mean, they got pretty good reviews. I was reading the reviews. I was impressed.
I was surprised. And to be honest, there was actually, you don't want to read too much reviews. And I will say this is easy for me to say, but if you do get negative reviews on something, it doesn't matter. It's fine. And luckily, I am in that headspace because I see these very positive reviews or very negative reviews that somebody is emotionally invested in what I'm doing, and they pretty much kind of almost mean the same thing. So negative reviews don't bother me. Yeah. There are occasions I could kind of find them funny. And I've actually heard people say that they've read a negative review about something I've written back in the past, but something the person complained about, they're like, oh, I kind of like that sort of thing that person said they didn't like, and then they've purchased it based on a negative review. So don't worry about the negative reviews at all. Not at all. But yeah, you just do it for yourself until you find your people, until you find your tribe, and they will find you, you know, and it might not be huge. It doesn't need to be huge.
I agree.
You know? Yeah.
Yep. I agree. And that's, you know, that's where I started with podcasting and it's turned into this nonprofit and I don't care, you know, one guy, 1,000 guys, it don't matter to me. You know, I enjoy doing it. I have a regular job. You know, I work as a maintenance supervisor. So none of this is income based for me. This is what I do when I get off work, and this is how I relax. You know,
I think with yours, you know, you're putting your passion into this, you know, and you're trying to help other people out. And I think people pick up on that and that positivity and the love that comes from that. I think people relate to that. So kudos to you, man. Really, sincerely. For what you're doing. And I know you feel, I would expect you feel this way. Even if one person in 3 years hears that and makes their life just a little bit better, well, of course it's worth it. Absolutely worth it.
You know, I'll tell you a funny story and it did make me feel really good. I had been podcasting almost to the end. It just recently happened. I had a gentleman that applied for a position where I work and during the interview, he said, I seen on his resume that he was a veteran. And I said, oh, you're a veteran. I said, what branch? He said, Navy. I said, oh, well, that's good. I said, if you said Air Force, this interview would have been over. So at least I know you work. And
yeah, right.
You know, so we was joking and everything. And we ended up hiring him. And it was about two, three weeks after we hired him, he came up to me and he said, You're Donald Dunn. I said, well, congratulations. You know who your boss is. I'm the guy that hired you, you know? And he said, no, he said, you've got that Jeep out there that says two drunk dudes in a gun room on the back window. I said, yeah. I said, it's a podcast that I do. He said, no, I know. He said, a buddy of mine told me that I should listen to that podcast. He said, I've been listening to it now for a few weeks. He said, I didn't know that it was you. He said, "Is it an awesome podcast?" And that made me feel really good that somebody from out of my circle, you know, listened to it because my kids don't listen to it. So I mean, I was like, "That's awesome," you know. It did make me feel good that he liked it and he could relate to it and you know, it's good.
Yeah, there's the affirmation side that somebody's getting something out of it or a bit of the praise, which is nice. But there's so much more joy in knowing that somebody is taking something from it.
Yeah.
That somebody, it's, you know, I have no illusions that any of my books are going to change anybody's life. But on occasion, someone will say something, hey, listen, you know, I've had emails or messages on Facebook, somebody saying, I was going through a really tough spot and I just got lost in your world, these stories. And so I have to go to work every day. My father just died. And I look forward to the time I get to sit down with your characters and get lost in their world and have fun. And I mean, wow, that's powerful, man. That is overwhelming that somebody finds that kind of solace in something you've written. It's one of the greatest gifts somebody could ever give me. Yep. And in that way, they feel I'm giving them a gift. So that's a pretty great world to be a part of.
You know, I'm going to tell you something that I found to be the best tool. When we first had this, I created an app, and in that app, it had a chat line that somebody could reach out if they just were having a hard time and they wanted to chat. And a few people used it. And I will tell you, most of the time when I was talking to somebody that I didn't know, that was another veteran, the topic that why they were depressed or going through a hard time never came up. We talked about bullshit, you know, the weather, funny stories, because most of the time what people need is that time to give their brain a break, to catch its breath, and think about something other than what they're struggling with. And if you can give people that time to laugh today so they can live tomorrow and live to fight another day, that's important. And
I think that there's also an element of the fact that we don't listen to each other much anymore.
You're right.
You know, the folks that are coming and speaking with you on the phone or whatever, they just need someone to listen to them. And they're so often you'll be talking with somebody and you can see the look on their face. They're waiting for my lips to stop moving so they can make their point and get their piece in. And I've tried my best over the last decade or so to really not shut down, but hold my stuff back and listen to somebody and be into what they're talking about. And you see that lift them up higher and higher because you're listening to them, you're invested in what they're saying, and you sincerely care about what they're caring about. And that if more people did that, man, this would be a much better world.
I agree. I agree. And you'd get to know what they need more. You know, you could learn to help them, you know, because, you know, just kind of like American politics, if you're telling people what they need, then you're not helping them. You're telling them what they need and you don't really know, you know?
Right. 100%.
That's kind of where I feel like we put ourselves with all these wars. You know, we told all these countries you need to be America, and we risked veterans' lives and did a bunch of damage to tell them you need to be America. So, So let me ask you a question. Where is your website that I've had going here? Is that the best place for people to go to find your books? And is there like a waiting list for the books that are coming out?
So Kane is going to be probably right now. There's three books, a third one coming out in December, late December. Book one came out in August. Book two came out about 6 weeks later. I was planning on just doing three books. But as I ended this book, and again, flake alert, I know it sounds flaky, but as this was ending, the characters are like, no, we got one more in us. And so it's going to be either four or five books of this particular series. But it's a fun one. And I would say, like I said, I learned so much from writing like the Hellink series and the Swordsman that if you read this, and I'll say this for your listeners and viewers, if you read through the book, And even if you're not into monster books, because I'll be honest between you and me, I ain't into monster books either. I just like a good story.
Yep.
And this is basically, the long and short of it is about, there's a wolf in British Columbia up in Canada, and this infected man comes by. We find out later he was a soldier, experiments, this sort of thing. This infected man comes by, just manic, bites the wolf, and then transfers some of that virus to the wolf. And the next day, the wolf turns into a human, and over a year grows into a full-grown human, a 6'7" French-Canadian, of course. And so his name is Kane. And Kane is, obviously, he's learned French and English because of the two lovely people that raised him for that past year. And he ends up meeting up with, because it turns out that wolves who become human, they don't really understand language, spoken language they got, but written language they can't do. The other thing that troubles him is driving, because they can't get that eye-hand coordination. It doesn't make sense. So he finds this young woman to drive for him, because he's trying to investigate to find out more about this guy who bit him. Because if he can find this guy who bit him, he might find what he needs to know to get back to his pack, to return to become a wolf again. And that's his quest in this entire thing.
Okay.
Because he misses going and running through the woods naked. I mean, he could run through the woods naked, but he might get incarcerated at that point as a human. So Imelda, who's a part-time criminal, maybe did some getaway driving. She's a great driver. And so she gets hired on by him and then gets invested in his quest. And so And what I do like about it, and we were talking a little bit about this earlier, is both these people were kind of broken in some way. They don't quite fit into the world as much as they wish they would. They're kind of like square pegs and the world is a big round hole. But when they come together and they sort of lift each other up a bit and they sort of shave those corners off of each other to where they do start to fit into the world a bit more. Mm-hmm. And this is a lot about how their relationship, not a romantic relationship, they're friends, but this is about how these two very different people come together on this same quest to be able to find out who this biting man was so Kang can return to his pack. And there's monsters along the way that they gotta battle and secret government organizations and people say it's funny. People seem to think it's funny. But I will say, you were talking about writing, because I know a lot of our veterans are interested in putting stuff down on paper and writing. If you read through the book, I'm open to any question. Email me or Facebook me or whatever and say, hey, why did you do this? And I will tell you. I will explain as best I can. If you want to get on the telephone, if you're thinking about writing a book, I'll give you my number. We'll chat about it. And I'll walk you through some of the ideas behind it. Because there are tricks and there's some ways to get yourself out of corners. There's ways to put yourself in those corners you have to work yourself out of. But I would definitely, any of the veterans that are watching or listening right now, if you want somebody to give you some advice on, you know, choices being made or the ideas that you should be using or techniques, I'm open to it. So if you want to, you know, borrow it from Amazon, you can do the KNEP, the Kindle Unlimited, or pick it up. It's $2.99. But if you read through that and you go like, I'm fascinated to know, how did this go from here to here? Or how did he come up with this? Shoot me a note and I'll answer it as best I can. I'll keep answering until you and I get or understand how that worked.
That's awesome. That is awesome. Well, I appreciate it, Dick. If you don't mind we'll go and throw the exit video and everybody, the dickwybrow.com. I've already checked out this website. It's awesome. You can go from there and find the books that he's got coming out. You can also go to Amazon and like I said, you can type in his name and you'll find a lot more books that are not just on his website as well. So I highly encourage it. Some amazing stories that will make you laugh. I've had a great time, Dick. I want to have you on again because when this is done, I want some time to go through and read some of these books and have another chat again. So it was a great time. Y'all take care, be safe, and we will see you next time.